Home Show presents Second Darkness, Children of the Void. Second Darkness is a six-part adventure path set in the Pathfinder universe. This is the campaign that introduces the dark and deadly Drow Elves to Galarion. And as we discovered last time, the Drow have already been hard at work weaving their webs across Phyrexia by the time the PCs stumbled upon them. Now, in part two, titled Children of the Void, the PC set sail for the Isle of Devil's Elbow to investigate what appears to be a falling star. They soon find themselves trapped on the island with strange alien beasts, all the while drawing closer to unraveling the twisted plots of the Drow. Author Mike McArthur was sadly not available, so here with me to discuss this installment of Pathfinder is Editor-in-Chief James Jacobs. Welcome to the show, James.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going great. Now, you've been with Paizo for a really long time. How many years has it been?
Oh, it's hard to keep track. I think around six, though.
Wow. And what were you before that? Were you a freelancer?
Yeah, I was doing a lot of freelancing before that. I was also working at Wizards of the Coast in the sales department and on the web team various jobs. And then
how was that working in the sales department of Wizards of the Coast?
It was a little weird. I mean, at one point, it's just like a normal old job where you're working, you know, putting data into the computers for orders and stuff like that. And
you're a data jock.
Wizards of the Coast, so it's kind of a weird kind of combo. It's like half real job, half dream job type thing, I guess.
Yeah, I kind of have that thing. I work for a candy company. I'm not going to say which one on the air, but anyway, so you are here because Mike McArthur, author of Children of the Void, could not be here.
Correct.
Why don't you describe to me the plot of Children of the Void, which is the second part of The Second Darkness?
Sure. Let's see if I can do this without giving out too much spoilers. But basically, what happens?
No spoilers.
No big spoilers. But the main plot of the adventure is that a meteor has hit this island, and
yes.
There's this basically the idea is that meteors have in them all sorts of sky metal and like adamantite and all this other really rare metals. And when this meteor hits this island, which is several hours away from the town of Riddleport, which is this town of pirates and scurvy knaves and desperate people of all sorts, it basically starts sort of like a gold rush type thing. And a bunch of these organizations get together and just mount these expeditions to this island called Devil's Elbow. And the adventure is about your player characters are one of these groups, one of the last to arrive at the island to come looking for traces of sky metal and other nefarious goings on the island. And you basically find out that there's more than metal that was brought down by this meteor. And it goes basically from there, kind of like an explore the island and find out what's going on down there.
Yeah, there's a lot of there's a lot of adventure in being alone on an island, sort of stranded with weird creatures that you don't quite know what they are. Kind of has a feel almost like Jurassic Park, I want to say,
it's very much when Mike was writing it. One of the things that I told him to look at for inspiration was basically like science fiction movies, like Aliens or Jurassic Park's another good example. Even stuff like Night of the Living Dead or Night of the Creeps, down onto like old movies where like it came from outer space or other movies where this thing crashes out in the woods or somewhere, and like The Blob is a great example too.
Mm-hmm.
Just movies where this meteor hits, and the original working title of the adventure was Attack of the Meteor Monsters, which I'm sort of sad that we lost that one. But Children of the Void is a lot more a lot creepier and a less silly sounding, but.
Yeah, sounds like the title of a Star Wars movie, actually.
But I mean, at the same point, the adventure itself is very much in the tradition of like the old science fiction type horror science fiction movies and stuff like that.
So. Yeah, I always it's really interesting when sci-fi intrudes on fantasy. It's really pulpy and weird. It's not quite serious, but it's still fun.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that's really that we're doing a fair amount of with Galarion, the setting for all the Pathfinder adventures, is that it is very much a Dungeons and Dragons style fantasy world, but it's not one that is It's not one where we're going to be waving our hands and saying it's magic, it's magic. A lot of it is based in science. Science is what built the world. There's like plate tectonics and there's an outer space and there's all sorts of stuff like that that it's really interesting to see how that type of thing interacts with the more fantasy type genres.
Now, is all of this because Eric Mona loves pulp fantasy and currently has his Red Planet series coming out, or
The Planet Stories series.
Planet
That's
Stories? I got the name wrong. I'm sorry.
no worries at all. That's part of it. Also, part of it is that I'm also a huge fan of the pulp. So a lot of us here at Paizo are really big fans of science fiction and the older types. And basically, a lot of the stuff from the old Weird Tales and Astounding Stories and Amazing Stories and all that stuff are very much the same stories that inspired Gygax and Kuntz and Dave Arneson and all them in the first place. I mean, you look at the old first edition Dungeon Master's Guide, where it has that list of Appendix N, I believe, the list of recommended reading, and that's all. A lot of that is authors like.
If you want to send me a mint copy of that, I would be happy to look at that table. But anyway,
Cool.
continue.
It's just authors like Robert E. Howard and Lovecraft and Fritz Leiber and a lot of just authors who are writing pulpy type stuff.
I have to say I was not a fan of pulp until I got my Planet Stories subscription and I started reading it and that's J.R.R. Tolkien will always be my favorite author, but pulpy is definitely fun and definitely more fitting for a game where the object is to sit down and have fun and not worry about things too much.
It's basically, I mean, to a certain extent, it feels a little bit like junk food, but a lot of those authors back then are also just they were really accomplished authors. Like Leigh Brackett is one of the more popular authors in the Planet Stories line, and of course she was one of the wrote Empire Strikes Back, which a lot of people have heard of too.
Yes, I believe I've heard of that film. Okay, so and this adventure also, well, I mean the entire adventure path is about the Drow, but why don't you describe to me how this adventure brings us more brings the Drow more into light?
The whole thing about the Drow is I was listening to the interview you guys did with Greg Vaughn last a couple episodes ago, and he really hit the nail on the head basically when he said that a lot of this is basically reinventing the Drow and not necessarily reinventing them, but going back to their roots and just rediscovering them, I guess is the best word for it. For first adventure, we just wanted to put one Drow character in there, and that was, make the main bad guy a Drow and let the PCs like kind of organically discover what's going on. And then with Children of the Void, we're at throwing more in. So there's a lot more Drow going on. There's Drow are certainly involved with the strange things going on the island here, and you end up fighting several of them throughout the course of the adventure. And then as Second Darkness goes on, you're going to be fighting more and more and more Drow in each adventure.
Now, Wizards of the Coast already sort of went back to the roots of the Drow with, I believe it was Expedition to the Demon Web Pits, which was sort of towards the end of 3.5. They were like, oh, we're bringing back the old school Drow who are mean and nasty and not the sort of romanticized Drizzt type Drow. How are Galarion's Drow? How are they unique?
How are the Galarian Drow unique?
Yeah.
We had part of the thing there too is we don't want to make them too unique, because if we make things too different than they were in classic, then they're not really Drow anymore. We can't still use like Lolth and all of the Drow gods, so we had to basically come up with a bunch of new demons for them to worship and all that. One of the big areas that we've gone into more detail in the Drow. I mean, there were hints of this in previous Dungeons and Dragons products, but the Drow of Galarian are a lot more into like flesh crafting and flesh warping, which is to like basically mutations and stuff like the Drider is the pinnacle currently of this art they have, and they have this ability to basically cause mutations and either on a full body scale transforming a creature into an entirely different creature, or on like a more body part scale, like giving somebody a big crab pincher or like weird eyes that can see in the dark, kind of like grafts and stuff like that. And we're going to be covering a lot of that later on in the Second Darkness story arc.
Now, one thing that I noticed is that Drow
in Galarian, they really seem to represent the dark side of elves, because even normal elves, they can turn into drow just by embracing their sort of dark side, their negative emotions. They can actually become drow.
Right. And that's another thing too. I mean, because since we don't have Lolth or any of that backstory and all that stuff, that's all Wizards of the Coast's intellectual property, and it's a great story, and it was really a kind of a stumper for us to figure out how are we going to make something that's as cool as what Wizards has done with Drow, and we got to make it our own. And that was Jason Bowman's big idea, was that if a normal old elf is, cruel and evil enough, maybe they can spontaneously transform into drow, and that adds a whole new kind of weird sort of disease or plague or curse type element to drow. And rather than having them be punished by some external force, they kind of did this to themselves. And at the same point, that happened so long ago that the drow are now kind of in the position that maybe they're not actually a curse. Maybe that's the natural evolution where all elves are going to be going. So it gives a really interesting spin to the whole, concept.
Elves in Galarian seem rather sinister in general. So just the fact that they can get even more creepy and dark is just probably very scary if you're an adventurer.
Then Pat, the fifth adventure in this series, A Memory of Darkness, really dives deep into that sinister element of elves and stuff. There's really not many drow in that adventure,
Let's
but
not
there's a lot.
get ahead of
It's a
ourselves,
two-part
because
adventure.
that's another show. How
Heck,
come
excellent.
you wouldn't let Greg have drow weapons that melt in sunlight? That's what he said when I
Ah,
talked to
we went back and forth, actually. Greg helped me write the End of the Darklands book also, so he and I did a lot of work together on getting the drow of Galarian working right. And he kept trying to get me to have the disintegrating and sun drow weaponry. And the problem with that is that the third edition of the game is the first version of the game that really has kind of an economy of items and all that. Like item value, items have value, and that the whole game is kind of balanced on that. And once you get a weapon that kind of self-destructs like that, you get this weird scene where, the weapon is more valuable because you don't let your enemies get a hold of it. That's something more valuable than a normal weapon. And what that means basically is, since the weapons are more valuable, then by game balancing it out, you can't give as much weapons to drow characters because their weapons are more expensive. And then when their weapons disintegrate, all of a sudden the player characters, who are expected to get more loot and stuff from looting the dead and all that, they have less equipment than you should think that they should have. So it's this really crazy, weird, complicated situation that we
But
just
isn't that sort of
basically wanted to
the
play.
Gygaxian tradition is sort of surprising your players with stuff that's not necessarily
Best for them. Now, that said, there is, I believe, a sidebar in the End of the Darklands book, which is coming out pretty soon, that talks about how, if you do want disintegrating drow weapons, here's how you do it. So the basic assumption in Galarian is that they don't disintegrate in the sun, but if you want them in your game, we give you rules for how to do that anyway. So it's
Sounds
kind of
really
a
cool.
have your cake and eat it too situation.
Now there are two other big articles in this issue, and I'm not sure we're going to get to talk about both of them, but I really want to talk about Into the Black, because Spelljammer was one of my favorite old settings, and I never delved too deeply into it, but D&D in space is just cool. Why don't you speak about Into the Black?
Cool. One of the things that I really liked about Spelljammer was, like you said, it's D&D in space, and it's like an entire new realm that you don't really see much happening. And it also opens up all these weird planets and stuff like that. One of the things I personally didn't really like much about spelljamming or Spelljammer setting was that it got too high fantasy, and it basically, that's not how outer space works. And it's outer space is already exotic and interesting and exciting enough that you don't need to change it. And so for Galarian, we basically have the setup that the material plane is the entire material plane is basically the universe, which is already a pretty big place, and there's all these different planets and stuff out there. And originally, Eric Mona was supposed to write this article, and then he realized that he just doesn't have time. And James Sutter actually stepped in and said, "I want to write it. I want to write it." And he did. He knocked it out of the park, really. It's just great stuff in there.
Yeah, this really sounds a lot like the Planet Stories books that I've been reading. This whole article does.
Yeah, and that's
Now,
actually another thing too, is that eventually we'd love to do like a Red Planet, Green Planet type thing, which is kind of a more of a pulp Planet Stories type campaign or something like that. But we don't. We're right now still focusing on Galarian. But this article is basically one of the things that this was going to do was set that those different regions and realms and stuff like that. So they're out there.
There's enough planets here to give you D&D games into the next century, I would think.
Oh,
Now,
absolutely.
yeah, it's now it's now now obviously Castrovel the Green is Venus, or the pulp version of Venus, and
Yes.
Akaton the Red is the pulp version of Mars. Do all of the other planets have definitive sort of analogs in the real world,
They sort of do. I mean, there's more planets in our system than in the solar system, so it's
Yes, I did
obvious
notice that.
that there's some off, but I mean, like, we have two big gas giants, and and then we have one really close to the sun planet that's this like just blasted with heat and all that. But then there's a, so basically what Sutter James Sutter did when he started working on this is he took all of the stuff from our solar system and then just started tweaking it. It's like, what if one of these planets has such a crazy orbit that it basically went into like deep freeze and then superheated as it went through the super long orbital year thing, and then others like, what if these other planets, these gas giants have all these planets around them and moons? What if they're like mini solar systems and all that? So,
What's your favorite planet in this article?
oh wow, I like Galarian an awful lot, and that's kind of a cop out, but that's the one that I've been working on the most. But it's also the home base. So if I had to knock that one out of the system, I would probably say Auchtern's my favorite, because that's the one that is the most Lovecraft. I mean, there's something going on there. That's basically
It's
kind of
very,
Yuggoth.
yeah, very Yuggoth.
Yeah, there's something. I mean, one of the things that James was thinking is like, it's a big egg, and inside of it is a great old one. It's like, okay, that sounds cool to me.
Sounds cool
So.
to me too. All right, and we've got the next in our series of God articles. I guess you can't call them what you used to call them in Dungeon anymore.
Or in Dragon, yeah, we called them. I don't remember. I can barely remember what's going on in the Dragon side of things, anyway. But yeah, we
Divine.
basically just call them. It's the same, and we got Sean Reynolds to write them, and he was doing the ones in Dragon too. So that just made it seem like a obvious choice, and we just call them by the deity's name. And
It seems like every adventure path you have one article about a good deity and one article about a bad deity. Is that the design?
It's mostly by design. I mean, we can't do that. There's way more good deities and good and neutral deities than evil deities, so we can't do that, forever. And in fact, in this one, we've got Cadan Calian here in this one, and then the next one we're doing in 17 is Callistria. And neither of them are really bad guys. I guess Callistria is could be a bad deity, but in this case, they're both deities that player characters could end up worshipping. So that's pretty cool.
Okay.
It gets a lot of players more options.
Yeah, I definitely like Caden seems very much the adventurer
Yes.
deity. Like if you just had to pick a default deity for adventurers,
Yeah, he is very
this
much
would be
the.
the guy.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just really great seeing all of a lot of these deities are actually from my own homebrew campaign that I've been running for forever. And it's really cool seeing some of these guys just, with the cool art and just have Sean go into all sorts of detail on them. So they're one of my favorite series of articles that we've been doing.
Everyone loves the deities articles, but one of the things that people also loved about Dragon Magazine was the Demon Lords articles. Are you
Yeah.
going to have any of those
Well,
in upcoming?
eventually, in the last in this series, like I was mentioning earlier, the Drow do worship demons. So, in the last of these, we'll be talking about that in a later show, I guess. But there's a big article that I just finished writing called "Demon Lords of Galarian," and it
All right.
details 29, the 29 most common demon lords worshipped on Galarian. So, each demon lord gets basically a couple of paragraphs of information, so it doesn't really go into as much detail as I did on the Demonomicon articles. But
Okay.
eventually, I'm sure that we're going to be doing something bigger and more along the lines of those articles for the Demon Lords.
And then to finish out the issue, we've got the usual Pathfinder journal with our good friend Eando Klein. I've been following his adventures since issue one. I have to ask, is this going somewhere? Is he gonna find this thing?
Oh yeah, it is. It's actually with Second Darkness, the Eando Klein story arc is going to come to an end. So in
Okay,
Pathfinder 18.
not that I'm not enjoying it. I'm just wondering if he's ever going to get to where he's going, because he's
Oh
kind of been
yeah,
going for a long time.
he has been, and we've kind of strung him along a bit longer than I think we should have. Yeah, it's the poor guy has been captured like 50 times,
And his friends keep dying.
Yeah, I know it's terrible, but it ends up pretty good. It's pretty cool ending the way where it ends up, and then with
Okay.
the next one, of course, we're moving on with a new character entirely.
Now I have to ask, just because fiction in Dragon Magazine was always sort of a contentious issue, what is the purpose of these sort of fiction articles?
The purpose is basically to detail a part of the world that is not really attached to anywhere else that's going on in the direct adventure. So you'll see, I mean, they're pretty close, but a lot of them are like detailing areas that we aren't quite doing in the same adventure, and we're doing it in a different way than just doing like a gazetteer or something. And it's basically just a way to present the information in a more entertaining manner. And one of the goals of Pathfinders is, of course, to present a game supplement that you can use to run adventures and all that. But at the same point, its goal is to just present some fun reading, and just doing fiction, flat out fiction, is a great way to entertain a reader.
I want to sort of ask you, how long do you expect the average gaming group is going to take to get through one of these adventure paths, like in real time?
I think on average that it's probably somewhere between 9 months and a year. I think we've got a lot of readers who play them pretty much as they come out, and then we've got a lot of readers who basically, really stretch around. We've got people still playing Savage Tide and Age of Worms and such, and so it's really boiled down to individual style of play. But I think on average it's anywhere between a half a year to a year to get
I'm
rolling.
always just sort of amazed at those groups that can sort of buckle down and focus and get through modules in that short of a time. Because when I game with my group, we're talking about stuff. We're
Yeah,
not.
that's the same with me. And you get distracted, like the game master just mentions. Well, the guy behind the counter's got a lazy eye, and everybody suddenly fixates on him, and he's not even part of the adventure. And it's easy to get distracted.
But I want to play all these adventure paths, but I just don't have time. I wish there can you can you clone me? Do you have the technology at Paizo yet to clone gamers so
Well, the
that they
problem is if we had the technology to clone people, we'd be cloning ourselves so that we could get caught up, and then of course we'd have a lot of people, and then there would be
That's
more
amazing
books
that
coming out, and yeah, that would be a never-ending cycle.
that's amazing that you're able to put out two adventure paths a year plus Pathfinder modules, what is it, every month? And
It's a pretty brutal schedule, but so far so good. I mean, we're it's tough to stay on schedule, and
maybe you'll
anything
need
can throw them
to
off us.
hire people.
Yeah, well, we're actually looking right now for an intern, so anybody who's in the Seattle area and in college, come
Looking
on over
for
to the
a
paizo.com and check it out.
looking for a knowledgeable D&D player who is good at making coffee.
Yeah, and good at catching typos and spelling errors too.
All right. Well, I believe our time is almost at an end. So
All
thank
right.
you for joining us, James. It was wonderful talking with you, and I look forward to doing so again, hopefully in the near future.
Yeah, sounds good.
That was James Jacobs, Pathfinder's editor-in-chief. To find out more about Pathfinder and their wide range of D&D products, you can visit paizo.com/pathfinder. Also, be sure to check out our own homepage, thetomeshow.com, where you can browse past shows, join a discussion in our forums, or visit our Amazon store to purchase the D&D products you've been looking for. This has been The Tome Show Presents Second Darkness. I'm Jeff Wynn, and thanks for listening.